Welcome to Reader's Digest, brought to you by Owl Radio, a community service of the Low Vision Resource Center in San Antonio. I'm John Fisher, and during the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from Reader's Digest. First, an article of national interest. DNA analysis is the most reliable crime scene tool, having exonerated dozens of wrongly convicted people, but it can sometimes lead to tragic mistakes. This investigation, published in partnership with Reader's Digest, The Marshall Project, Frontline, and Wired. Here's I Think I'm Innocent by Katie Wirth from Frontline and The Marshall Project in Reader's Digest. When the DNA results came back, even Lucas Anderson thought he might have committed the murder. "I drink a lot," he told public defender Kelly Kulik as they sat in an interview room at the jail in Santa Clara County, California. Sometimes he blacked out, so it was possible he had done something he didn't remember. "Maybe I did do it." Kulik shushed him. "Lucas, shut up," she said. If she was going to keep her new client off death row, he couldn't go around saying things like that. But she agreed. It looked bad. "Let's just work through the evidence to really see what happened." Before he was charged with murder, Anderson had been a 26-year-old homeless alcoholic with a long rap sheet who spent his days hustling for change in San Jose. The murder victim, Ravish Kumra, was a 66-year-old investor who lived in Monte Sereno, a Silicon Valley enclave 10 miles and many socioeconomic rungs away. Around midnight on November 29, 2012, three men broke into Ravish's 7,000-square-foot mansion. They found him watching CNN in the living room, tied him up, blindfolded him, and gagged him with duct tape decorated with pictures of mustaches. They found his ex-wife, Harinder Kumra, asleep upstairs, hit her on the mouth, blindfolded her, and tied her up next to Ravish down in the kitchen. Then they rummaged for cash and jewelry. After the men left, Harinder, still blindfolded, felt her way to a phone and called 911. Police arrived, then an ambulance. One of the paramedics declared Ravish dead. The coroner would later conclude that he had been suffocated by the mustache duct tape. 3.5 weeks later, the police arrested Anderson. His DNA had been found on Ravish's fingernails, suggesting that Ravish had struggled as the intruders tied him up. Anderson was charged with murder. Kulik was appointed to his case. Anderson tried to make sense of a crime he had no memory of committing. Nah, I don't do things like that," he said. "But maybe I did." Months would pass before anyone figured out what had really happened, which was that Lucas Anderson's DNA had found its way onto the fingernails of a dead man he had never even met. Back in the 1980s, when DNA forensic analysis was new, crime labs needed a speck of bodily fluid, usually blood, semen, or spit, to generate a genetic profile. But in 1997, Australian scientist Roland van Oorschot stunned the criminal justice world with the discovery that some people's DNA appeared on things that they had never touched. He called the phenomenon, quote-unquote, secondary transfer. One of his lab's experiments had three people sit at a table and share a jug of juice. After 20 minutes, their hands and the chairs, juice glasses, table, and jug were swabbed and tested for genetic material. Although the volunteers never touched one another, their DNA ended up on each other's glasses and hands. Then there was the foreign DNA, profiles that didn't match any of the juice drinkers. It turned up on about half of the chairs and glasses and all over the participants' hands and the table. The only explanation, the participants had unwittingly brought with them alien genes, perhaps from the lover they had kissed that morning, the stranger with whom they had shared a bus grip, or the barista who had handed them an afternoon latte. In a sense, this isn't surprising. We leave a trail of ourselves everywhere we go. One person can shed upward of 50 million skin cells a day. We also spew saliva. If we stand still and talk for 30 seconds, our DNA may be found more than a yard away. DNA is the most accurate forensic science we have. It has exonerated scores of people who had been convicted using more flawed disciplines, such as hair or bite mark analysis. Meanwhile, there have been few publicized cases of DNA mistakenly implicating someone in a crime. Nevertheless, the itinerant nature of DNA has serious implications for forensic investigations. After all, if traces of our DNA can make their way to a crime scene we've never visited, aren't we all possible suspects? When Corporal Aaron Lunsford, a 15-year veteran of the Los Gatos Monte Sereno Police Department, arrived at the Kumra Mansion, he walked past cop cars clustered around a brick and iron gate as the lights from a silent ambulance flashed in the driveway. Inside, dressers were emptied, files dumped. A refrigerator beeped every 10 seconds, announcing its doors were ajar. A pile of latex gloves was left in the kitchen sink, wet and soapy, as though someone had tried to wash off the DNA. Ravisha's body was on the floor near the kitchen. He was still blindfolded. Lunsford recognized Ravish, a wealthy businessman who had once owned a share of a local concert venue. Lunsford had also run into him at Goguen's Last Call, a dive frequented by Ravish as a regular and Lunsford as a cop responding to calls. Ravish was an affable extrovert, always buying rounds. In the coming days, Lunsford would discover that Ravish had relationships with sex workers. In the weeks after the murder, Tawny Nelson Mehmet, a criminalist at the county crime lab, ran dozens of tests on the evidence collected from the Kumra Mansion. Most revealed DNA profiles consistent with Ravish or Harinder. But then Mehmet hit forensic pay dirt, a handful of unknown profiles. She ran the DNA through the state criminal database and got three hits. 22-year-old D'Angelo Austin on the duct tape, 21-year-old Javier Garcia on the gloves, and on the victim's fingernail clippings, 26-year-old Lucas Anderson. Police records showed that Austin belonged to a gang linked to a series of home burglaries. His older sister, a 32-year-old sex worker named Katrina Fritz, had been involved with Ravish for 12 years. Eventually, she would admit that she had given her brother a map of the house. Connecting Anderson to the crime proved trickier, but eventually Lunsford found a link. A year earlier, Anderson had been locked up for a felony residential burglary in the same jail as a friend of Austin's named Sean Hampton. Hampton wore an ankle monitor as a condition of his parole. It showed that 2 days before the crime, he had driven to San Jose, right near Anderson's usual haunts. It started to crystallize for Lunsford. When Austin was planning the break-in, he wanted a local guy experienced in burglary, so Hampton hooked him up with his jail buddy, Anderson. Anderson had recently landed back in jail after violating his probation on the burglary charge. Lunsford and his boss, Sergeant Mike D'Antonio, visited him there. "Does this guy look familiar to you? What about this lady?" Lunsford said, laying out pictures of the victims on the interview room's table. "I don't know, man," Anderson said. Lunsford set down a letter from the state of California showing the database match of Anderson's DNA to the profile found on the victim's fingernails. "This starting to ring some bells?" Lunsford said. "My guess is you didn't think anybody was going to be home," D'Antonio said. "My guess is it went way further than you ever thought it would go." "I don't know what you're talking about, sir," Anderson said. "Lucas, Lucas, Lucas," D'Antonio said. "I don't have a crystal ball to know what the truth is. Only you do. And in all the years I've been doing this, I've never seen a DNA hit being wrong." Anderson had been in jail on the murder charge for over a month when a defense investigator dropped a stack of records on Kulik's desk. They were Anderson's medical records. Because his murder charge would carry the death penalty, Kulik had the investigator pull everything pertinent to his medical history, including his mental health, in case they had to ask for leniency during sentencing. She suspected that Anderson could be a candidate for such leniency. He'd spent much of his childhood homeless. In early adulthood, he was diagnosed with a mental health disorder and diabetes. And he had developed a mighty alcohol addiction. One day, while drunk, he stepped off a curb and into the path of a truck. He survived, but his memory was never the same. He lost track of days, sometimes several in a row. That's not to say his life was bleak. He made friends easily. Kulik and her investigator had spoken to several of them. Anderson might be a drunk, they said, but he wasn't a killer. His rap sheet seemed to agree. It was filled with petty crimes, drunk in public, riding a bike under the influence, probation violations. The one serious conviction, the residential burglary, seemed more benign upon careful reading. According to the police report, Anderson had drunkenly broken the front window of a home and tried to crawl through. The horrified resident pushed him back out. Police found him minutes later on the sidewalk, dazed and bleeding. He was charged with a felony and pleaded no contest. His DNA was added to the state criminal database. More recently, the medical records showed that Anderson had been taken by ambulance to Valley Medical Center, where he was declared inebriated nearly to the point of unconsciousness. He spent the night detoxing. The date was November 29th. If the record was right, Anderson had been in the hospital precisely as Ravish Kumra was dying. Kulik knew Lunsford would try to find holes. Perhaps the date on the record was wrong, or Anderson's ID had been stolen. So she and the investigator retraced his day. They found a record that put him at S&S Market in the early evening. The clerk there told Kulik that Anderson had sat down in front of the store at about 8:15 p.m., already drunk, and had gotten drunker. A couple of hours later, he wandered into the store and collapsed. The clerk called the authorities. Two paramedics arrived in an ambulance. They wrestled Anderson onto a stretcher and took him to the hospital. According to his medical records, he was admitted at 10:45 p.m. The doctor who treated him said Anderson remained in bed through the night. Harinder had said the men who killed Ravish rampaged through the house sometime between 11:30 p.m. and 1:30 a.m. Kulik called the district attorney's office. She wanted to meet with them and Lunsford. In the year 2009, German detectives were on the trail of the quote-unquote Phantom of Heilbronn. A serial killer and thief, the Phantom had murdered immigrants and a cop, robbed a gemstone trader, and munched on a cookie while committing a burglary. Police mobilized across borders, offered a large reward, and racked up more than 16,000 hours on the hunt. But they struggled to discern a pattern to the crimes, other than the DNA profile the Phantom left at 40 crime scenes in Germany, France, and Austria. At long last, they found the Phantom, an elderly Polish worker in the factory that produced the swabs police used to collect DNA. She had somehow contaminated the swabs as she worked. Crime scene investigators had, in turn, contaminated dozens of crime scenes with her DNA. Contamination, the unintended introduction of DNA into evidence by the very people investigating the crime, is the best understood form of transfer. And after Lunsford heard Kulik's presentation and retraced Anderson's day himself, he concluded he had jailed an innocent man. He counted contamination among his leading theories. In Santa Clara County, the district attorney's office reviewed the Kumra case and found no obvious evidence of errors or improper use of tools in the crime lab. They checked whether Anderson's DNA had shown up in any other cases the lab had recently handled and inadvertently wandered into the Kumra case. It had not. It was Lunsford who figured out the answer to the riddle of how Anderson's DNA ended up on Ravish Kumra. He was reading Anderson's medical records and paused on the names of the ambulance paramedics who'd picked up Anderson outside S&S Market. He had seen them before. He pulled up the Kumra case files. Sure enough, there were the names again. 3 hours after picking up the drunk Anderson at the market, the two paramedics had responded to the Kumra mansion. Somehow, the paramedics must have moved Anderson's DNA from San Jose to Monte Sereno. District Attorney Jeff Rosen has postulated that a device slipped over both patients' fingers to measure oxygen levels may have been the culprit. Detective District Attorney Kevin Smith framed the incident as a freak accident. "It's a small world," he told a San Francisco Chronicle reporter. But it was hardly a small mistake to the defendant. Had the case gone to trial, jurors may well have convicted Anderson, as they did the other three defendants. A third man, Marcellus Drummer, was eventually arrested. A 2008 study found that jurors rated DNA evidence as 95% accurate and 94% persuasive of a suspect's guilt. We're desperately hoping that DNA will come in to save the day, but it's still fitting into a flawed system, says Aaron E. Murphy, a professor of law at New York University and author of Inside the Cell, The Dark Side of Forensic DNA. If you don't bring in the appropriate amount of skepticism and restraint in using the method, there are going to be miscarriages of justice. Having narrowly escaped a terrible fate, Anderson himself has advice for law enforcement officers. "There's more that's got to be looked at than just the DNA," he says. "You've got to dig deeper, reanalyze, do everything all over again before you say, this is what it is, because it may not necessarily be so." Next, from Reader's Digest, from the section called "I Am the Food on Your Plate," here's something from Kate Lewenstein, the editor-in-chief of Vice's health website called Tonic, and Daniel Gritzer, the culinary director of the cooking site Serious Eats, with "Potatoes, All Eyes on Me, the World's Dream Starch," in Reader's Digest. "It's complete darkness through day and night where I am. In the silence of the cool, loosely packed earth, I'm reproducing. My eyes shoot forth stems, millimeter by millimeter, into the dirt around me. Above ground, my green leaves bask in the sunlight, photosynthesizing sugars, which ease downward to nourish nodes along those stems. The nodes then swell with flesh, new potatoes in the making, each one a perfect clone of me. Cloning myself in the dark isn't the only way I reproduce. My second means of reproduction is fertilization of my flowers by another potato plant, and any variety will do. This insurance policy has given me maximum flexibility as a multiplier over the ages. Today, 8,000 years since humans began cultivating my ilk near Lake Titicaca in the Peruvian Andes, taxonomists have no idea how many cultivated and wild versions of me exist. I am the Solanum tuberosum, a member of the nightshade family and a close cousin of tomatoes, eggplant, peppers, and tobacco. Don't let our shared moniker fool you. I am no relation to the sweet potato. She's correctly described as a root vegetable, whereas my edible part is the stem, swollen into a starchy, filling snack. Thousands of years ago, I was but a knobby knot in the ground, hardly edible, at times even poisonous. In the dirt-caked hands of generations of farmers, I've been bred so that my bitter glycoalkaloids, the compounds that to this day make me go green after one too many days on your windowsill, are at safe-to-eat levels, and my edible insides have expanded to accommodate the human appetite. As a result of this happy coexistence with my cultivators, I've hitched my way all over the world and adapted to life on continents outside my home turf in the Americas. I can live at 12,000 feet in the dry, chilly mountains and at sea level in the tropics. My appearance is as varied as the places I live. I can be white, yellow, red, purple, pink, or blue, speckled, spotted, coiled, or mottled, knobby, smooth, thin, or stumpy, covered in skin that's thick and leathery, or as thin as tissue paper. Despite this dazzling diversity, a North American shopper will encounter only a few varieties: russets, which are very starchy and thus good for baked potatoes and fries; Yukon Golds, which are moist and waxy and great for producing a silky mash; fingerlings and new potatoes, delightful when boiled; and red potatoes, perfectly tender and sweet in a potato salad. Around the world, I take many more forms, from soft purees to shatteringly crisp potato chips. I'm rolled into cloud-like dumplings in Italy. I bulk up Guinness stews in Ireland. And I grace the tables of France's haute temples of gastronomy, usually laden with butter and cream. Yet, I didn't become the fifth most abundant crop across the globe in the year 2016 as an indulgence. I am a true staple, highly storable, surprisingly nutritious. Civilizations have depended on me. The Incan Empire grew on my back, its soldiers subsisting on me as they marched through harsh mountain terrain. Europeans relied on me through lean times, sometimes too heavily. My nemesis, the fungus that produces late blight, attacked me in the mid-1800s in Western Europe and nearly collapsed Ireland, where about 1 million people died. More recently, I've been identified by NASA as a food seemingly made for astronauts on missions, as I offer all 9 essential amino acids, the building blocks of proteins necessary for humans to maintain themselves. And now in parentheses, that subplot of the movie The Martian, in which the Matt Damon character lives on potatoes alone, may not be too off base. Even the whitest and blandness of my brethren contain potassium, fiber, and an array of potentially cancer and heart disease-fighting polyphenols in their flesh and skin. My most abundant polyphenol, chlorogenic acid, which is associated with lowering blood sugar, is important for diabetics. Today, scientists on Earth are breeding bio-fortified versions of me with double the normal iron content to feed parts of the world where anemia is pervasive. They are using genetic modification to develop a potato fully resistant to the fast-moving late blight, which is still the most aggressive threat to me. There is also a significant effort to develop varieties of me that tolerate the stresses of drought, soil salinity, and heat as climate change presses in on staple crops like me. Dare I say, that's progress for a tuber that got its start underfoot in the silent darkness. And now for this sidebar to potatoes, all eyes on me, the world's dream starch. This is perfect boiled fingerlings. Put whole fingerlings in a pot and cover with cold water. Now add salt, starting with 1.5 tablespoons per 4 cups of water. Then sprinkle in more until the water tastes as salty as the sea. In parentheses here, don't worry, most will go down the drain and the little that's absorbed will make all the difference. Now add aromatics, garlic, a halved onion, carrots, celery, a bay leaf, and fresh herbs such as rosemary, thyme, and sage. Bring water to a gentle simmer and cook anywhere from 25 minutes to 2 hours until you can slide a fork into a potato without resistance. And now in parentheses, the larger the potatoes in batch, the longer they'll take. Turn the heat off, leave the potatoes until the water is warm. Discard the aromatics and herbs, drain the potatoes, and toss with melted butter or olive oil and minced parsley, chives, and or tarragon. Add black pepper and salt to taste. Perfect boiled fingerlings. And finally from Reader's Digest's Who Knew section, here's 13 ways your cell phone affects your body and mind, collected by Michelle Crouch of Reader's Digest. Number 1. First, some good news. Your cell phone can keep you safer. A study in the Journal of Emergency Medicine that analyzed emergency dispatches over an 11-year period revealed that 137 more lives were saved per 100,000 patients when people called 911 from a mobile phone rather than from a landline. Number 2. But there are plenty of concerns, too. Scanning your phone right before bed can disturb your slumber. The short wavelength, bright blue light your device emits boosts your attention during the day, but at night the light can inhibit the production of melatonin, which helps you fall asleep. To avoid that, make a habit of not using your phone for at least 30 minutes before you close your eyes. Number 3. When you are awake, a single buzz-buzz signaling a new notification on your phone can weaken your ability to focus on a task, researchers at Florida State University have found. Switch your phone to, quote-unquote, do not disturb mode to remove the distraction. Number 4. Putting your phone aside when you're alone, rather than taking it out to play games, can help inspire creative ideas. When you're bored, 4 different areas of your brain activate and work together to pull in random thoughts and combine them in unique ways, says psychologist Larry Rosen, author of The Distracted Mind. Number 5. Americans now spend more than 5 hours a day swiping, typing, and tapping, and feeling achy because of it all. Quote-unquote, selfie elbow is a strain injury caused by holding your elbow at an extreme angle, and 85,000 people a month search for, quote-unquote, texting thumb and similar terms on Google. Number 6. Most cell phones are crawling with germs, 10 times what you would find on most toilets, says University of Arizona microbiologist Charles Gerba. Wipe your phone down daily with a gadget-friendly antibacterial wipe or a microfiber cloth. Number 7. That said, your phone can help you be healthier. In a study of overweight volunteers, those who used a smartphone app to record their food intake were much more diligent than those who used a paper diary or a weight loss website, and they lost almost twice as much weight. Number 8. Radiation exposure, long thought to be a risk for heavy-duty phone users, is probably not a significant concern. Smartphones do emit radiation, but most scientific evidence has not linked the use of a cell phone to cancer. One draft study found that exposing male lab rats to the highest levels allowed for cell phones was linked to one type of rare tumor in the tissues surrounding nerves in the heart. If you're worried, use earbuds or a headset when you talk on your phone. Number 9. Navigating by consulting a map and trying to remember it may be better for your brain than passively relying on step-by-step instructions from your phone's GPS. Researchers found that older adults who chose the more active approach increased activity in the hippocampus, a part of the brain important for memory. We're at number 10 now of the 13 ways your cell phone affects your body and mind in Reader's Digest. Snapping a pic with your smartphone may also hinder your memory. On a test after a visit to an art museum, students were less likely to remember objects they had taken photos of. As soon as you hit click on that camera, it's as if you've outsourced your memory, says psychologist Linda Hinkle. Number 11. Your phone can do a number on your eyes. About 60% of Americans experience digital eye strain symptoms, such as dryness, irritation, blurred vision, eye fatigue, and headaches. Try blinking often, increasing font size, and taking a break from screens every 20 minutes. Number 12. We all know that walking around town with your face in your phone can be dangerous, and there are studies that underline the point. City pedestrians using their phones looked left and right less often and were more likely to be hit by a vehicle, according to a review of studies on distracted walking in the Journal of Traffic and Transportation Engineering. In another small experiment, 94% of pedestrians who were using cell phones to talk and text didn't see free cash hanging from a tree. That's right, they walked right by a bunch of dollar bills. And finally, number 13, it would be easy to avoid all these maladies by simply putting down your phone. The problem, it isn't so easy. That twinge of phone separation anxiety is real. In fact, Rosen says, detaching from your phone can cause your brain to release the stress hormone cortisol. Of course, there are many phone apps with calming names, such as Forest and Mute, to help you control your phone addiction. Or you can just let the battery run down and forget about it. And that'll do for today's edition of Reader's Digest. Thank you for listening. If you have questions or comments about the program, please call us at 210-829-4223. This program is replayed after 9 o'clock in the evening. This is John Fisher saying goodbye from Owl Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center in San Antonio.